Good morning. You are tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine. At its weekly meeting last night, Boulder City Council heard the latest news on the coronavirus pandemic. But equally disturbing was an announcement about the expected loss of city revenues and the necessary furlough of 700 employees. We'll have more coming up after headlines. Then, yesterday, the official campaign for the national popular vote in Colorado was launched. This November, voters in this state will be deciding whether or not that Colorado should join the compact that would guarantee the candidate receiving the most votes in the presidential election be the winner. We'll get a report. After that, Earth Week in a virtual space. It's happening in Denver. Well, indeed, everywhere next week. We'll hear from the Alliance Centre. Then Make Them Hear You. After headlines from the BBC and a commentary from Jim Hightower, we'll continue our coverage of the Conference on World Affairs, which happened online last week due to the stay-at-home restrictions. We'll hear this morning a panel that took place last week with experts talking about COVID-19 and the need to listen to scientists. At 9:30, we'll start a morning of music on the Morning Sound Alternative. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sittler.
A new study is warning that 450,000 renters in Colorado are at risk of being evicted when current guidelines against removing tenants expire after the coronavirus crisis is over. The Colorado Sun reports that the analysis has been done by the COVID-19 Eviction Defense Project, including economists at the University of Chicago, among others. While some local jurisdictions in the state have informal and temporary moratoria on evictions, the governor has so far declined to issue an executive order banning them, saying he lacks the power to freeze rent or interfere with housing contracts. As we previously reported, the Denver City Council passed a resolution Monday night calling for a rent freeze. Delaying eviction proceedings, however, does not mean that tenants can avoid back rent and late fees, and they will still face eviction after bans are not in place. One of those involved in the study, attorney Zach Newman, said that the state is not prepared for what the world is going to look like when the various moratoria on evictions are lifted. Many renters and activists have already organized a Colorado Rent Strike and Eviction Defense page on Facebook. Cities in the metro area are facing the projected financial effects of the COVID-19 crisis on their budgets. Longmont City Council learned yesterday that they are looking at a shortfall of over $15 million. The city has begun to look at possible solutions, including tapping unspent money carried over from 2019 and some unappropriated balances. Longmont City Manager Harold Dominguez told the council last night that lost revenues are a significant financial issue for local governments. The Times Call reports that a number of municipalities have already announced temporary staff and cutbacks, including Broomfield and Nederland. Officials in Denver say that furlough days for city employees could be used to cut costs until the crisis is over. The city is preparing to lose $180 million as it anticipates a 12% drop in tax revenue. The city spokesperson for Emergency Joint Information Center said in an email to Colorado Politics that right now they are not implementing furloughs, but they would be evaluated. The city of Boulder on Tuesday announced furloughing hundreds of employees, and we'll have more on that after headlines. The Boulder Valley School District got its first look at the budget scenarios for the upcoming school year. The Daily Camera reports that the board is facing the possibility of cuts if the state reduces funding due to coronavirus shutdowns. The state legislature has been suspended until the middle of next month, and by then, the district's chief financial officer said they will have a much better idea of where things stand. If the state were to cut the district's budget by as much as 5%, Boulder Valley would have to cut nearly $4 million in its budget. The coronavirus is affecting Hispanic, African American, and those from Hawaiian and Pacific Islands who are in Colorado at higher rates than other ethnic groups. In preliminary data released yesterday from the State Department of Public Health and Environment, cases among Hispanic Colorados are about 28% of reported cases, while making up 22% of the population. African American confirmed cases represent 7% in the state, despite making up just 4% of the state's population. The department said that there are racial disparities for certain diseases due to unequal access to health care and economic opportunities occurring over many generations. Yesterday, immigration attorneys in Colorado sued ICE and the GEO Group in an effort to release medically at-risk detainees from the detention center in Aurora. Attorneys say that conditions at the Aurora facility ensure that there will be a COVID-19 outbreak among detainees because employees are not using personal protective equipment, there are insufficient cleaning supplies, and social distancing is not being followed. The Rocky Mountain Immigrant Advocacy Network, the National Immigration Project of the Lawyers Guild, and the law firm of Arnold and Porter filed the case in federal court, alleging that the detainees are being deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process. The Colorado Independent reports that as of about a week ago, nearly 530 people were being held at the facility. Should there be an outbreak, the suit says it would become a death sentence inside the detention center. The City of Lafayette City Council is expected to vote next week on whether to extend its moratorium on oil and gas operations. The Daily Camera reports that last November, the council extended its moratorium until May 30th because it was thought that the Boulder County and Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission would have revised their rules sometime by early this spring. But some rulemaking has been delayed due to the coronavirus. An attorney for the city told the council that it should extend the moratorium for 6 months. In today's weather, we'll see partly sunny skies with a high near 52 and a chance of rain after 3, with rain and snow likely tonight. Tomorrow, there will be snow with an accumulation of 2 to 4 inches and a high of 35. Right now, it's about 37 outside. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It is 11 minutes past 8 o'clock. Hours before the Boulder City Council held its weekly meeting on Zoom last night, the city announced it needs to furlough hundreds of employees at the end of this week due to economic fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic. KGNU's Ros Brown says council members absorbed that information along with the latest from health officials about local impacts from the virus.
Friday will be the last day for 737 City of Boulder employees, 175 regular workers, and 562 seasonal temporary employees, victims of the COVID-19 pandemic. In a press release, the city said since stay-at-home orders took effect, preliminary loss of revenues are estimated to be $28 million, about 10% of annual revenues. That means 3 out of every 8 city employees will be sent home on Friday, a 38% cut in staff. Capital improvement projects also will be delayed or canceled, and additional layoffs have not been ruled out. With that grave news, council moved on to an update from local health officials about the status of how the coronavirus pandemic is impacting the community. Boulder County Public Health Director Jeff Syak said the death toll from COVID-19 in Boulder County as of Tuesday was 15, and 290 people have tested positive. He said more tests are critical.
We know we have more people in the community that are positive that have not been tested, so we would expect to see more cases come forward that we would then want to do that isolation and quarantine and contact investigation on so that it holds that surge down and that we don't have people ending up in hospitals.
Colorado's stay-at-home order has been extended by Governor Jared Polis through the end of the month, and Zayac emphasized how important social distancing will be in the next 2 weeks.
This is, again, another plug to say to people, please follow those orders, stay at home. That's going to make a big difference. We want those case counts to stay down and sustain down for the next 14 days.
Even though new infections of COVID-19 have not stabilized, the number of coronavirus tests analyzed each day nationwide by commercial labs plummeted by more than 30%. Over the past week. Dr. Robert Vissers leads Boulder Community Hospital.
I am pleased to report that we did start doing testing at Boulder Community Health as of yesterday. We only received 30 test kits, so we are capable of doing these tests. These tests are actually very accurate, and the turnaround is 2 hours. Because we have limited supply, we're using them for where we need that immediate answer, a woman who's coming in labor or a critically ill patient. But we are hoping to get a larger shipment later this week.
Vissers also expressed concern that some people who may need immediate healthcare attention could be avoiding the hospital over fears about COVID-19, but emphasize that the hospital is ready to care for them.
The stay-at-home order, we've seen a significant reduction in patients, for example, with chest pain. It's only two-thirds of what it was prior to that. We know that heart disease hasn't suddenly diminished in our community. So while we expect traumatic injuries to decrease, We would expect these other medical emergencies and urgencies to continue. And so my other message is that the hospital is an incredibly safe place to be right now. Every single person is screened daily. If there's even a hint of symptoms, they're sent home and they're tested before they return to work.
Both Vissers and Ziyech encourage people to wear masks, not just when they enter stores to shop, but anytime they're outdoors, especially to walk or hike. Hikers have been practicing social distancing and wearing masks more this week than last, according to Open Space and Mountain Parks Director Dan Burke, but he added that non-compliance is still as high as 30% at busier sites.
In the past week, there's been a really noticeable shift. Certainly still hear a lot from people, and we do still receive feedback about concerns with social distancing compliance. What we see this week is we received a lot more feedback from community members who desire to keep our trails open and the benefits being out on open space.
Burke said visitation levels remained higher than normal in the past week at 11 open space sites where automatic trail counters have been installed. That may mean implementing weekend or rolling closures at targeted locations.
What we are thinking and of doing is partnering with Boulder County, temporary closure during parts of the weekend of Flagstaff Road. And that temporary closure would begin at the Gregory Canyon trailhead.
Burke said his department is still receiving complaints about street parking congestion near popular access points, but it's down from previous weeks. For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
You can find all of our coverage of Boulder City Council as well as the COVID-19 pandemic online at news.kgnu.org. Well, Earth Week is coming up and there were so many events planned around the world and right here in Colorado. But with the current pandemic, those events have moved online. Brenna St. Ange is the executive director of the Alliance Center in Denver, and they're kicking off their virtual Earth Day events this Saturday.
This year, 2020, is actually the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. And for months, the Alliance Center was working with Earth Day Network. They're actually the founders of Earth Day. And we'd been co-leading a coalition of over a dozen partners across the Front Range of Colorado to plan the largest Earth Day celebration since 1970. And we had over a week of action-packed events focusing on climate solutions and youth mobilization and civic action. And once it became clear that it was no longer safe to hold in-person events, we quickly had to make a shift to virtual engagement. And we have a bunch of online resources now and calls to action so people can remain involved and connected even while practicing social distancing. And I've just been so impressed with the group and just the professionalism and resilience and the ability to adapt very quickly. You know, I think it took us about a week to kind of turn on the dime from when we realized we had to adapt until we had the plan in place, and then have been pulling together all the things that we need to launch Earth Week on Saturday, April 18th. And we're actually calling it the Earth Week 2020 Inside Edition, so providing different ways for people to engage in the safety of their own home. And we have many different themes that we've pulled together that actually mirrored kind of what we would do in the public events that we were planning. And so it all starts on Saturday the 18th, and it starts with the Get Outdoors Day and safe ways to get outdoors and enjoy the beautiful nature that we have here in a safe way, given the pandemic. And then we have a whole bunch of activities planned throughout the week that, again, you can do in your own home. Monday, we have a mindfulness and meditation session. We have days on regenerative agriculture and local food systems, waste diversion, how climate change can be a bridge. And then we also have other days devoted to arts and culture and the intersection with the environment, as well as youth climate leadership. So we really try to provide a whole variety of topics that, you know, different people could be interested in different days, participate in one, participate in all. It's kind of a choose your own adventure with virtual engagement. And part of it, actually, that I think is one of the really exciting parts of this digital transition actually includes launching a new podcast, and we're calling it the Climate Bridges podcast series. And the first podcast will actually premiere on Earth Day, April 22nd. And it's going to feature Dennis Hayes, who is a founder of Earth Day, and Liliana Flanagan, who's a high school senior, and she's a youth climate activist from Grand Junction, Colorado. So the goal of the series is actually to create an intergenerational bridge. And we're pairing emerging climate leaders with veteran climate activists, and they're discussing what drives them and the challenges they face and how they think we can best solve our most pressing problems. So this is just the first of several podcasts we'll be producing through the end of the year. And the conversations will range from food security to the circular economy to you know, what each of us can do in our own backyards and daily lives. So each podcast will end with a call to action, providing tangible steps that each of us can take after listening to celebrate Earth Day every day. And, you know, the last note on this is, I think it's so important with the pandemic to recognize, you know, yes, the pain and suffering it's causing, of course, to hold space for that, but also to recognize the great opportunity that we all have to pause and to reflect on what's really important in life and to give us this chance to collectively get off the hamster wheel and to reset our behaviors in both small and big ways. And the podcast series and Virtual Earth Week is designed to help people do just that.
To that end, Brenna, in terms of the opportunities that the current situation might offer as we move forward, there's been so much discussion about how quickly we've seen policy enacted, executive orders being implemented at a federal and a state level around this emergency, that if we saw the same passion and action and acknowledgement of the crisis that currently is facing the environment and particularly the climate crisis, that the future would look very, very different. I mean, do you see and the programming that's lined up for Denver Earth Week and what's happening all next week, that there's a way that we can kind of pivot the conversation to really say, you know, look what can be achieved when you have a global crisis? Because so many people are saying, you know, the climate crisis is really at the same level almost, albeit it's a less tangible thing for many people.
Absolutely, Maeve. You know, I really appreciate the question, and I have several thoughts that I'll try to boil it down to just two to keep it simple. But, you know, first, I think that it's really important for the human psyche not to overwhelm people with the convergence of these two crises. But it's really important to focus on the solutions and the ways people can get engaged in both big and small ways, to give people tools to take action and to find control in their personal lives when at the global level, things may seem way out of control. And that is exactly what we're doing with Virtual Earth Week, is to show people how you can pivot and take this as an opportunity to either continue down the path you've always been on or to completely reinvent your life. You know, now's a great time to start fresh and start over if there's areas around your environmental impact or, you know, other areas, so to speak, that people want to kind of retool their lives with. And Virtual Earth Week is providing the resources needed to do that. There's tons of resources on the webpage there and information people can really apply to their lives. And, you know, secondly, I think you're absolutely right. There are many parallels between COVID-19 and climate change. And while we're all affected, every single one of us, it's changed every aspect of our day-to-day lives, it's hitting our most vulnerable populations the hardest. And, you know, you mentioned policy and democracy, and the deterioration of our democracy has also hindered our ability to respond at a federal level to both this global pandemic and to climate change. And, you know, on the other side of that, though, I do see a great transformation, this amazing opportunity we have to reimagine and reinvent the very systems our society is based upon. As I said earlier, to reset and refocus on what's really important in our lives. And one silver lining, a silver lining in all of this, is that currently our environmental impact has decreased. You know, planes are not flying, cars are not driving as much, and all of this helps reduce the carbon we're emitting right now. But the hard truth is that we've been way over Earth's carrying capacity for many years and in many ways, and especially with our carbon emissions. And you know, the numbers aren't totally firm right now, so don't quote me on this, but we could be looking at the largest single drop ever in CO2 emissions. And that's amazing. You know, that is a silver lining, but a 1 year drop in emissions is not enough to get us to 2 degrees or to 1.5 degrees. So the real key here, in my opinion, is how we rebuild, how we come out of this great global pause. And we have the opportunity on our hands to rebuild just like we did out of the Great Depression. And, you know, you kind of asked about how could this change the future or the trajectory to take the lessons from the Great Depression and how we rebuild back then, but rebuild now with renewable grid systems and localized resilient economies and a tidal wave of green jobs. The Alliance Center, actually, the last thing I'll say on this is the Alliance Center is actually working on a series to apply lessons learned from COVID to from COVID-19 to help us rebuild with equity and sustainability as key principles so that we can be more resilient the next time a crisis comes.
That's Brenna St-Ange, who is the executive director of the Alliance Center in Denver. They're kicking off their virtual Earth Day events this coming Saturday. And you can find out more about the events on Saturday and all next week online at thealliancecenter.org. It's 8:24. You're listening to KGNU. Well, the national popular vote, which guarantees the candidate receiving the most votes in a nationwide tally becomes president, will be on the Colorado ballot this November. Colorado's yes on national public vote, national popular vote, kicked off on Tuesday with the first in a series of online town hall meetings. Colorado's national popular vote legislation, in fact, passed the state legislature and was signed by the governor in 2019. However, the bill contained a petition clause. Senator Mike Foote, who's part of the Yes campaign, outlined some of the background of the bill.
The idea of a national popular vote is not new at all. There have been several congressional debates and votes taken as far back as 1969, 1979. There's votes on the record from then about doing a national popular vote. The idea of the national popular vote interstate agreement, which is what we have in Colorado now, first started in the mid-2000s. The first state to pass it was Maryland in 2007. It was introduced in Colorado, I believe, around the same time, perhaps 2006, several times of discussion and debate before it actually ended up passing Colorado.
Senator Foote says that the compact requires that the Electoral College votes from those states to be cast for the presidential candidate who received the most votes nationwide. And it will come into force when enough states representing a majority of the Electoral College agree to the compact's procedure. And that would guarantee that the Electoral College thereafter will select as president the most popular candidate in the ballot box.
Right now, there are 15 states plus Washington, D.C. that have signed on, and that represents states with a total of 196 electoral votes. 270 are needed to win the presidency, so for this to go into effect across the country, there would be enough states with 270 electoral votes to sign on, meaning that currently we're 74 electoral votes short. There are other states, as far as I understand, that are considering it this year, but I don't see any scenario where there will be enough states signing on this year for it to take effect for the 2020 presidential election, but perhaps by 2024.
Well, to date, much of the funding for and against November's ballot initiative has come from outside of the state of Colorado, although Senator Michael Foote says this may change as the campaign effort ramps up.
The Colorado statewide election, but it does have national importance. And it's received national attention. Having national supporters, it doesn't just apply to the Yes on National Popular Vote campaign, though. The opposition has received a large amount of support from a think tank in Oklahoma, for example. So there's going to be nationwide attention and support for both sides of the ballot measure across the country. But we have been focused and will continue to focus on building our Colorado grassroots organization and our Colorado support and donors. And I think you'll see that reflected as time goes on.
Sylvia Bernstein, who's the Colorado Coalition Coordinator for the Yes on the National Popular Vote campaign, said yesterday that the campaign is happening in a virtual space right now because of the current pandemic restrictions. And she said that there are still 76 Electoral College votes needed to bring the Interstate Compact into force.
There are several states out there where one side of the legislature or the other has already passed this. Oklahoma has, Nevada, it passed the full legislature and the governor didn't sign it. Virginia was coming very close. There's a number of states out there that we are really close to getting it passed on both sides and signed by the governor. So it's hard to say, and especially right now in our current environment where legislatures are essentially shut down across the country. We just don't know which of those that have already started passing it are going to be the ones that are going to push it over.
Some of the voices from yesterday's telephone town hall, the launch of the official Yes on the National Popular Vote campaign in Colorado. And thanks to Eric Skase for that report. Time now for Make Them Hear You.
Make them hear you. Make them hear you.
This is Make Them Hear You with ideas how you can have your voice heard before Congress.
Did you read the op-ed published recently in the Washington Post by Senator Josh Hawley? A Republican from Missouri, Hawley calls for Congress to cover 80% of wages for American workers, offering bonuses for rehiring workers, strengthening supply chains at home, and cracking down on Wall Street. He wants rules for antitrust enforcement and corporate transparency. As Heather Cox Richardson wrote, quote, "This op-ed reads to me like Hawley thinks the radical anti-government fever that took over the Republican Party in the last generation is going to break under Trump, and Hawley is betting that a political future, even for a Republican senator, depends on embracing government activism," close quote. This is a remarkable recovery proposal for a Republican. Quote, "The federal government should cover 80% of wages for workers at any U.S. business up to the national median wage until this emergency is over," Hawley wrote. He wants Congress to, quote, "protect every single job in the U.S. since the federal government effectively shut down the economy to keep the virus from spreading. Several European countries, including Denmark, the Netherlands, and the U.K., are paying workers' wages for the next several months during the pandemic." In the op-ed, Hawley said it was imperative for Congress to think differently and be bold in the next coronavirus relief package. Hawley wants the government to cover 80% of employee wages for Americans until the pandemic ends. He also wants to offer companies a bonus to rehire people who recently lost their jobs. Quote, "The goal must be to get unemployment down now, to secure American workers and their families, and to help businesses get ready to restart as soon as possible," close quote. The plan comes while layoffs continue to destabilize the economy, forcing over 17 million Americans to seek unemployment benefits in the past month. It demonstrates the severity of the crisis and the willingness to consider radical solutions among lawmakers to meet the unprecedented scale of the disaster. Hawley also tweeted, "The job losses are staggering. Congress must act now to save every job in the country and rehire those laid off." According to the Associated Press, 10% of the U.S. labor force is now out of work, and 6.6 million people have filed for jobless aid. The price tag for such an endeavor would be enormous. According to the New York Times, if the feds cover the paychecks of the entire workforce, it could cost around $5 trillion in the next 6 months. Efforts in the U.S. are focused on ensuring people can access enhanced unemployment benefits after they've lost their jobs. But many people have reported difficulties accessing that insurance as state offices are overwhelmed. If you have thoughts on Josh Hawley's proposal to cover 80% of employees' wages, you can contact your senators and representative. This is Chris Moore with Make Them Hear You.